Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the summer of 2015, today's guest, Anand Giridharadas, stood at a podium in Aspen, Colorado, telling a room of rich and powerful people that they're not the saviors they think they are. In 2011, Anand was named a Henry Crown Fellow at the Aspen Institute. The program seeks to deploy a, quote, new breed of leaders against the world's most intractable problems. In 2 years, over the course of 4 one-week sessions with a group of 20 classmates, he made many friends, some who had private jets and mansions. But in his 5th year in the program, he was asked to give a talk to a few hundred of his fellows at their summer reunion. And at that point, he began to question the program. He began his talk by saying, quote, "We may not always be the leaders we think we are." And here is an excerpt of that talk.
The Aspen consensus, to me, in a nutshell, is this. The winners of our age must be challenged to do more good, but never, ever tell them to do less harm. The Aspen consensus holds that capitalism's rough edges must be sanded and its surplus fruit shared, but the underlying system must never be questioned. The Aspen consensus says, give back, which is, of course, a compassionate and noble thing. But amid the $20 million second homes and $4,000 parkas of Aspen, it is a little gauche to observe that giving back is also a band-aid that winners stick on the system that has served them in the conscious or subconscious hope that it will forestall major surgery to that system, surgery that might threaten their privileges. The Aspen consensus, I believe, tries to market the idea of generosity as a substitute for the idea of justice. It says, make money in the usual ways and then give some back, whether it's through a foundation or factoring in social impact to your business plan or adding a second or third bottom line to your analysis or giving a left sock to the poor for every right sock you sell. The Aspen consensus says do more good, not do less harm.
And that is Anand Giridharadas, who was giving a talk at the Aspen Institute. Anand is a writer, a former columnist and correspondent for the New York Times, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU. His latest book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And Anand joins us in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
It's great to be back in this studio.
Well, it's great to have you. And I wanted to play that just to give listeners a sense of how you got to this place. After you gave this speech, you said that you were surprised because a lot of people were clapping, gave you a standing ovation. But Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, came on stage and gently disparaged your speech. I was wondering, what did she say exactly?
Something about how, you know, she thought America was a great country. And she listened very carefully to the previous speaker, but she thought America was a great country, sort of, I guess, implying that I didn't. And that she thought the Aspen Institute does important work and just sort of put me in my place. You are, there are certain things you're not supposed to say in every age. And in our age, particularly in these kind of powerful spaces, the thing you're not supposed to do is question the benevolence of the very rich.
You had a wide range of responses. Some people said that they've been grappling with this for all of their lives. Other people spoke ill of you behind your back. And then beside a fireplace, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, asked you if he could write about your talk. And that's when things kind of really took off.
Yeah, it was at first just in that room with a few hundred people, including many very wealthy and very powerful people. But it was sort of a... It was an intimate conversation, and I said sure to David when he wanted to write about it, and he wrote this really thoughtful column grappling with the fact that, you know, David's someone who believes deeply in free market capitalism and limited government as a conservative, And yet he felt that in this challenge, there was a new kind of critique of the kind of capitalism we were practicing in America right now that was worth listening to. And so he kind of aired it for his readers. And that led to, people saying, where's this speech? We got to read the original speech. So that I put that out on Medium. People started reading that, and it created a, miniature wildfire. Very soon after, I decided this is going to be my next book.
And then fast forward to 2018, and here you are in the Bay Area. You were just at Google, and you talked about why Google should be broken up.
Yeah, the backstory to that is, between the speech and now, what I've spent my time doing is reporting, right? The speech that you played the clip of contains a strong opinion. And I went into this, frankly, with a strong theory of what was going on, but I'm a reporter. And so what I did in the intervening time between the speech and now is report. And I went into these worlds of very wealthy, powerful people who are trying their darndest to do good and give back and make a difference and start social enterprises and give back philanthropically and start Silicon Valley companies that change the world. And I immersed myself in their lives and their efforts to do that and tried to figure out what was going on, because the reality is, even as they do all those things, America's as unequal as it's been in 100 years or maybe ever. Working and middle-class Americans have basically been passed over by the fruits of the future. 82% of new wealth created last year alone went to the top 1%. So the very people changing the world and making a difference are cornering most of the rainwater of progress. And so after the book came out, I started being invited to go to different things, bookstores and other things, but also in some courageous cases, some of the institutions that I indict. And Google has this authors series where they invite you to come in. So I actually went to the Google office in Boston and gave this talk. And I was just going to give my standard talk. And then on the train ride up, I thought, I'm going to Google. I shouldn't just give my standard book talk. I should talk about Google. And so I made some notes on the train. And I basically personalized it and said, Google is the epitome of this. It's a place that deeply believes that its mission is intrinsically humanitarian. And it has done many things that make the world better. It's true. The world is better with search than without it. But it is also a place that epitomizes the modern fantasy, elite fantasy, that what is good for me is good for everybody. What is good for the rich is good for the poor. What is good for Silicon Valley is good for humanity. And there are places where that is true for Google, and there are places where that story breaks down, and where what is good for Google has ceased to be what's good for the world. And the simplest example of that is the fact that Google is a monopoly in online advertising, and regularly abuses its market power to corner that market that has basically sucked the oxygen out of many businesses, including much of the news business. And so you have many parts of this country that don't have a media anymore. You have many states whose state legislatures basically are no longer covered by local reporters. And that is a very clear example of a place where what's good for Google is not what's good for the world. So I went to Google and I shocked this room full of engineers. It wasn't that full, I got to say, but, by saying, look, I'm coming here to tell you Google probably needs to be broken up. And they were like a little bit. There's nothing like the face of a shocked engineer. Then we had this whole conversation about what happened, what would maturity look like within the tech industry? And what I suggested to them is maturity means accepting your own arrival, accepting that the hackers and the rebels and the renegades that you all see yourselves as, you made it. You did it. Your hacking succeeded. Your revolution succeeded. Congratulations, you won. You're in the palace now. And you got to stop wearing the beret of a rebel army commander. You're in the palace. You're the kings. You did it. But that requires a sense of responsibility. It requires a sense of nobility. It requires a sense of grace. And powerful people who, Goliaths who think they're Davids are very dangerous. So I gave this talk. And then it took a very long time to show up online. We started inquiring what was happening. And they're like, well, the guy who, you know, the guy who kind of assigned me to give the talk said, I'm no longer associated with this project, which is like corporate America for like, please don't call me, don't call me. So they stopped taking my calls. You know, it got pretty bad. I let a reporter know from an esteemed American publication. That reporter started calling Google Press. I involved another person as well. And, you know, within hours, it was like, the talk's going to go up very soon. And so now the talk is live, and your listeners can check it out.
You know, what's so interesting about all of this is on this show, unlike, for example, CNBC, and you were on that show, it was kind of not amusing, but it was just interesting to watch the hosts question your criticism of philanthropy. We talk about inequality and the economy and all of these things on a regular basis on this show. But we are in the heart of this area, and we have done shows on Uber, on Airbnb, and these top executives will not come on the show. And so we don't have a foot in that world, even though we're neighbors with them. And I wonder, since you have interviewed so many of these people, you've got an article coming out soon about some of the top tech guys in the Bay Area. What insights can you give us about their thinking? Because, I mean, they're stepping over bodies on the streets. And it would be great if we can talk with them about this, but they rarely talk to the media. Or when they do, it's at these conferences where someone very friendly is giving them softball questions.
Yeah, I call those fallacial interviews. Look, the reality is, the word you used, a very important word, neighbor. Okay? And the fact that you use the word neighbor to refer to them marks you as a non-Silicon Valley engineer type, because you're referring to a language of community, of people actually, of citizenship, of people actually having obligations to each other based on physical place, based on belonging to something. That's not how they think. Okay? When you use neighbor, you're referring to a vision of the world in which, you know, places have a shared history. This guy Lewandowski from Google, Charles Duhigg, has this amazing piece in The New Yorker about this kind of pioneer of the driverless technology at Uber, who was, you know, attempted to be poached by at Google, who was attempted to be poached by Uber. And the piece ends with this guy's Google guy saying, you know, the future is all that matters. History is kind of interesting, Napoleon, wars, play, you know, but the future is all that matters. So the reason they won't come on your show is they don't accept your premise. They don't accept the idea that they're your neighbors. They don't accept the idea that they live in community with you. They don't accept the idea of living in a democracy in which they are just one citizen among other citizens. They don't accept the premise that you have any hold on them as a fellow citizen. They live in a stratosphere in which they create technological tools that they think entitle them to rule the world privately, to govern us privately. They are, in a way, these kind of like hoodied colonialists who expect to have power over others but refuse to have others have power over them. And it's not just here, you know, in some of the far-flung parts of this earth, where in Sri Lanka and Myanmar you have Facebook basically becoming the platform of ethnic killing. Mm-hmm. And people using, you know, these are countries that do not have established media the way we have here. And so there isn't the same amount of legit news that is circulating on a platform like Facebook. And so when someone comes along and plants a fake story about, you know, a rumor about a Muslim in their town or whatever, it goes viral. And many, many people have died because of that, right? And you have Kara Swisher on the Recode podcast asking Mark Zuckerberg, how does that make you feel that your podcast is being doing that? And he couldn't articulate a feeling. Mm. He couldn't articulate a feeling. These little boy men with, in many ways, some of the least developed social acuity of anybody in our society have become in charge of societal discourse, of the way we relate to each other, of our conception of friendship and neighbors. But to go back to the Sri Lanka thing, what's so interesting is in that big piece in the New York Times about Facebook and Sri Lanka, there was this quote from an official there, I think, who said, you know, they have tremendous power over us, Facebook does, but we don't have any power over them. Mm. There's a number we can call. They don't have people in the country. They've refused to set up an office as of that writing where you could kind of anticipate and shut down stories like that. And I think that's such a metaphor for this industry in general, and also explains why they won't come in and sit here. They're happy to have Facebook Live technology in this room broadcasting and then selling advertising against it. But they don't see you as worthy of a conversation.
When you say they, are you specifically talking about the high-level executives like Mark Zuckerberg and his circle?
Yes. And one of the things I've found in my reporting and in, you know, going around with the book over the last couple of months is that there is a schism within a lot of these Silicon Valley spaces. And there are a lot of young people mm-hmm. and women and people of color and people who just one way or another have been on the wrong end of a power equation somewhere in life and just see things a little differently, who are within these spaces, within these companies, who do not like what I just described and who recognize it completely, who don't yet have the power necessarily to do something about it. Some of them have some amounts of power and are poking in the ways they can. But I think we're going to see a very interesting phenomenon. You know, in Silicon Valley, generations are like 3 years instead of 15 or 30. But there is a generation gap between the people like Zuckerberg and the people who are coming up behind him. You know, you see someone like Zuckerberg, you just see someone who's so oblivious to power, his own power, just how power works, so in denial of the power that he wields, calling Facebook a community, refusing to accept that it's a very powerful mm-hmm. company that is possibly the first company in American history to allow a federal election to be compromised and perhaps tipped. And yet there are people who work for him who don't buy that, and we need to find ways to make sure we give them more and more voice.
Today we are speaking with Anand Giridharadas about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And if you have any questions or comments, if you work in Silicon Valley and you'd like to talk about what Anand just said and the argument that he's making, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. He's also talking about philanthropy, about TED Talks, about this whole thing that we now call thought leaders, which is now kind of an industry. What are your thoughts about all of this and the claims that they make to really be changing the world without talking about systemic inequality and how we got here? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And if you're in the Bay Area, Anand will be speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco, 312 Sutter Street. And then tomorrow night, he'll be speaking at the SOCAP conference. What does that stand for?
SOCAP. Social Capital.
Social Capital. The Social Capital Conference at the Fort Mason Center, 2 Marina Boulevard. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's at 8:30 in the morning in San Francisco. What is the Social
Capital? There's another event tomorrow evening also, third option.
Okay.
The Code for America is hosting, and all of that's on my Twitter, Anand Writes.
Okay. What is the Social Capital Conference?
I don't know in detail. It's basic. This idea of social capital is using capital to advance the greater good. It's precisely what I'm critiquing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my guess is always the emphasis is on cap, not so. But I'm going to go find out, and you know, they're going to go find out what I think.
And why are they inviting you to these conferences, given what you're talking about?
I think it's a great question, but I will say the following: that is my probably biggest takeaway from 2 months on the road and my children almost not recognizing me anymore, which is I think Donald Trump has done this country one enormous service, which is Donald Trump is for this nation what rock bottom is in the life of many addicts. When you manage to turn around, that night that makes you convinced that there can't be another night like this. And what I've found is that a lot of the winners of our age, the very people I am indicting and critiquing, are more open right now to introspection and to self-examination than they were even a year or two ago when I was doing this reporting. Because if Donald Trump is president, it means that a lot of what all of us thought was simply not true. If Donald Trump is president, it means that our assumptions about how to make this society work better were just flawed in so many ways. You don't get an orange Mussolini without multiple system failures in this country, without so many of us thinking faulty things. And so I, every day, I'm encountering people in these elite spaces. I kind of thinking, where were you when I was reporting this book? Who are actually saying, look, I think X, Y, and Z, but what do I know? Because Trump's president. Let's have a conversation. Maybe I need to change. Maybe my assumptions need to change. Maybe my organization needs to change. I am getting people out of the woodwork, kids who have accepted jobs at investment banks out of college, saying, you know what? Maybe I should revoke that and do something else. What else should I do? You know, I'm not a career counselor, but so I try to pass them on in the best way I can. People who are at large foundations saying, okay, I'm persuaded that I'm just upholding the system instead of actually shattering it. How could I give in ways that would shatter it? Mm. There is an openness right now in our country that is the warm underbelly of this ghastly era.
In the book, you write about the Clinton Foundation, and you have a bunch of quotes from Bill Clinton. Did you interview him?
I did.
Okay. That part made me really mad, because here he is, this, you know, brilliant thinker, and he was talking to you about NAFTA, basically, just in line with what you're saying right now. Well, when we passed NAFTA, maybe we should have added certain protections for workers. Well, maybe we should have done this. And what gets me the most is all of these people saying, maybe we should have. You have all of these grassroots organizations and activists who were banging on the streets saying these same things for years. They got it right decades ago, and yet here we are. Exactly what they said would happen, happened. And yet these guys, the brightest of the bright, are now saying, oh, maybe we made a mistake.
I think one of the things that's so interesting about Trump that is actually making people rethink, I'm not sure how much it's made Bill Clinton personally rethink, but others, is Trump is like a late warning system for public discontent and broken systems. But a late warning system is not a very useful tool. What you want is an early warning system. And early warning systems are those activists you talked about. I mean, I remember, you know, in 1999, when you had those protests outside the WTO in Seattle, mm-hmm. and they were kind of dismissed as marginal people, fringy people. I mean, Occupy, you know, 12 years later was 13 years later was similarly dismissed. I went to the University of Michigan and I took Econ 101, either my freshman or sophomore year, 1999 or 2000. And I remember we were in Michigan. And I remember learning in Econ 101 at the University of Michigan, like, trade in general benefits all parties. And we were in Michigan. If you drove half an hour in any direction from that campus, you saw that trade was shattering the society, shattering it. Right? And the Econ textbook said what it said, and the professor said what it said. And we were, a lot of us in the top, I don't know, fifth or tenth of American life, were completely impervious to all these people saying, hey, globalization not working for us. Hey, trade not working for us. Hey, this tech thing actually not lifting all boats. There was so much incoming transmission, to put it in radio terms. But the elites in this country in those years and in these years have only had outbound transmitters. And part of what we've now learned with Trump is all the discontent. And, you know, some of it's economic, some of it's about globalization, a lot of it is about race and status anxiety, and the intersection of all these things. And the interesting thing about talking to Clinton is I reported on his final CGI, mm-hmm. which he had in September 2016. It was the final one because they were so confident that Hillary would be president that it would be inappropriate to have a big fundraising conference once she was president. That event took place a couple months after Brexit and a couple months before Hillary lost. And then I went to go see President Clinton, you know, several months later. And we had this whole conversation, and I basically was trying to get him to say, you know, look, you guys made millions and tens of millions of dollars after leaving office. Do you at least see how hanging around with plutocrats and operating that world maybe was not the smartest choice for people who wanted to be back in the White House? He said, no. Hmm. I'm like Robin Hood. I pay most of my money to taxes and medical expenses for friends, and I'm basically taking money from the rich to give it to the poor, except I don't even hold an arrow on them. A total, in my view, inability to process the anger of others and all the messages that other people are giving in this age that all is not well with them.
Hmm. I guess that made me mad because in many ways you expect that from conservatives, and you're supposed to expect more from, you know, these corporate Democrats. And I mean, that's the other thing that's about your book is a lot of these people, if they're Republican or Democrat, they hold very similar views.
Well, I mean, look, I'm going to say two things about that. First of all, I'm not one of those people who says the Republicans and Democrats are the same. They're not the same, right? I mean, some of them want to ban homosexuality and others don't.
Of course.
Some of them think it's open season to sexually assault women and others don't. So there are real differences on a whole host of issues. But I think where that gets very true is that in every age in American history, we've kind of been living within the scope of kind of someone's theory, right? So whether you were a Democrat or a Republican between the 1930s and the 1970s, you were living in FDR's America, okay? The assumptions, the norms, the values, the kind of Overton window of acceptable change was set by FDR, okay? And so therefore, you had Republicans in that period. They were Republicans. They were conservative. They believed in limited government. But you had Richard Nixon creating the EPA. Right? And you had Republicans supporting high marginal tax rates. Why? Because they were all playing in FDR's field. His revolution had succeeded. They were all playing in his field. Since the 80s, and I believe we're still in this period, we've been living in Reagan's era in much the same way. And so if you believe in that revolution, it's been a great time for you. The interesting thing is, what happens when you're the loyal opposition within Reagan's era? And that's why, you know, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, I mean, these guys definitely believe in the power of government. They're not Reaganites.
Right.
But they're living, they're forced to live in Reagan's world. And what that means is you have Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over. You have Barack Obama, who I think believed in government more deeply than Bill Clinton, you know, creating the Office of Social Innovation, the first office he created, which says on its founding website, top-down programs from Washington are not how you make change anymore, which is a preposterous and untrue statement. So you have a generation of Democrats that feeling like they needed to exist and compete in the Reagan world that they lived in failed to make an equal and opposite case for government as against the rights case against it, who instead felt like they had almost absorbed as secondhand smoke the right's contempt for government. And their counter was, yes, we know government's not perfect and it's bloated and it's this and that, but how about this little program? Or how about that? Instead of saying, sometimes the more militant, assertive case for something is actually better at conquering middle ground. Mm. I actually think talking about healthcare as a human right is a more saleable idea than talking about healthcare as a way to bend the cost curve.
Yeah. And the Republicans are brilliant at that.
Yes.
Go for it.
And I think you got to – that's a very good point, because I think you got to separate substance in politics from how good people are at politics. The Republicans are very good at politics. Mm-hmm. Being very good at politics means making people certainly – fight for what their interests are and maybe even go beyond what their interests are. It means coining terms that reconstitute reality for people. And I'm not talking about lies. I'm talking about, you know, even things like calling the estate tax the death tax. That's very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good politics, right? Calling late-term abortions partial birth abortions. It's very good. It's very bad substantively, but it's very good politically. And I think the left has this like moral overconfidence and doesn't really play that game very well, doesn't know. And the left has the advantage of pushing a lot of policies that are good for like 70 to 80% of Americans, and yet is unable to kind of sometimes get down and dirty into that tawdry marketing stuff where you're really getting people at their hearts and not just their, you know, their wonky brains. Mm.
Today we're speaking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Anand Giridharadas. He's a writer, former columnist and correspondent for the New York Times, a political analyst for MSNBC, and the author of many books. His latest is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And if you are in the Bay Area, you can see Anand speak tonight at the World Affairs Council, 312 Sutter Street in San Francisco, 6:30. Tomorrow morning at the SOCAP Conference, 8:30 a.m., Fort Mason Center in San Francisco. And tomorrow night, 5:30, at Code for America at 1355 Market Street in San Francisco. And if you have any questions or comments for Anand, if you work in Silicon Valley, if you work for a foundation, if you'd like to talk about the philanthropic world and this whole idea of really changing the world that comes from a lot of corporations that got us to where we are, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a call from Sean in Oakland who couldn't stay on, but he wanted you to talk about the cost of attending a TED Talk, which can be up to $5,000 a person. I didn't realize that. Is that
more.
Right? More than
I think
that.
More, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, you talk about in your book, you interview and profile, I forgot his name.
Bruno.
And he is on the committee to determine who gets to speak at TED, on the TED Talks. And it's so interesting because whether it's the TED Talk or bringing someone in to give a keynote to your corporation, you're, quote, allowed to use the word poverty, but you cannot use the word inequality. And it really was interesting to me because we talk about problems on the show almost on a regular basis and also try to talk about solutions. But a lot of these people who make the decisions want you to come in with the solution. Do not talk about the problem, and definitely don't talk about how we got here.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, behind the caller's question is a very good point. I have a whole chapter about the death of the public intellectual and the rise of the thought leader. Mm-hmm. And part of what has happened, I mean, so when you hear a very expensive ticket to go to TED, you know, the first thought is, well, that's exclusionary. And that's usually what people's analysis is, you know, that you're shutting people out. And that's true. But I argue in the book there's a much deeper problem, which is that when you create gatherings full of very wealthy people as the audience, the talks themselves, the kinds of thinkers you invite, the kind of ideas that you end up promoting through those platforms end up reflecting the tastes of the attendees. And a lot of what has happened in our time is a lot of the traditional sources of patronage for ideas, whether it's newsrooms, which are about half the size they were a couple decades ago, whether it's academia, where now basically everyone's an adjunct. I mean, this woman who just won the Nobel Prize in physics had not yet been promoted to full professor, right? And even book publishing, where nonfiction advances are down and you know, there's like one big bookstore left. Mm. A lot of those were the kind of traditional sources of patronage for writers and thinkers. Well, with those things all wilting, what has taken the space of that, what taken up, picked up the slack is the speaker circuit. And you can speak at Aspen Ideas Festival and TED, where you don't get paid, but you get exposure, or you can speak in these kind of corporate lectures. And what happens is, you know, as Upton Sinclair said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. These thinkers are invariably feel a kind of pressure to change their diagnoses or leave a little bit of it out and change their prescriptions to meet the tastes of their benefactors. And that happens in every age with its patrons, but I try to chronicle how in this age with these particular patrons, this kind of new entrepreneurial tech-centered wealth, we've ended up kind of nourishing a cadre of thinkers whose expertise is to talk about social problems in ways that do not blame the winners.
Mm. Well, and to your point about that, I won't name the name, but we had an author of a really important book on recently who said that at night he bartends because he can't make ends meet. And he just wrote such an important book. And then there have been so many stories about adjuncts who in many cases, are one paycheck away from being homeless. There was one article recently about a professor at, is this San Jose State University, who grades papers in her car by the light of a headlamp. I mean, this is very common now, and it seems to be really getting worse in this area.
Look,
especially.
I mean, what you're raising are examples of something much bigger, which is we have to decide what kind of society we want to be.
Yeah.
I think one of the starkest examples of our time, there was this beautiful and dark New York Times piece a few years ago about De Anza College in the South Bay, which is, I think, probably the closest higher educational institution to Apple in Cupertino. And as Apple thrives, I think it now has $285 billion offshore. De Anza, where many Apple employees' kids swim, take swim lessons, which is right there. De Anza was suffering. Cutbacks, not having the money to employ as many teachers, a lot of people moving to adjuncts. I think the courses were slashed 25% one year. They just couldn't make ends meet. And we're talking a couple miles from the Apple campus in Cupertino. And you just think, look, there's a lot of ways to have some of that money go there. It could be through taxes, could be through philanthropy, could be whatever. And I have my preferences. But you just step back before that and say, what kind of society creates a company that builds all this technology, uses these idealistic ads about making the world a better place to sell that technology, generates $285 billion simply in offshore wealth, and allows a community college where the children of the employees of that company swim to wither on the vine? Is that the kind of society we want to be? It's certainly not the kind of society I want to live in.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from Teresa who says, maybe it was a charming move, but when Anand said how happy he was to be back in this studio, my heart sang. The KALW studio is way far from the Aspen Institute, but the care with which he is listening to Rose, me, and engaging with her questions convinced me of his sincerity and professionalism, a rare pair of attributes. I'm excited to read more about his research and his critique of what we're talking about today.
And I am back. I was here 7 years ago for my first book. So I am indeed back I remember driving around looking for it the first time too.
it's been a while. I mean, and for people who, you know, would like to know more about you, I mean, how did you find yourself in this world of the wealthy and the powerful? I mean, you talk about how you got lucky in choosing your parents and they sent you to really good private schools. But how did you end up, for example, at the Aspen Institute for so long?
Well, look, I mean, a lot of these very wealthy and powerful corporate people create these kind of fellowships, and they always allow in, I think, as, you know, let's be honest, a room full of business people is as boring a room as you could conceive of. So they often let in some other people, you know, with a little more levity and color in their lives, artists, you know, some philanthropic people, journalists, writers, whatever. So I was one of those people in the fellowship. But to take the question more broadly, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. My father called us the original Cleveland Indians. My parents are immigrants from India. And we had this kind of classic American immigrant story. They left India and built this great life in Ohio. And then I lived in France for 3 years. My dad got a job in France. Then lived in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. for several years. And I knew very early on I wanted to be a writer. Became a writer really in India. I moved to India after college, and I was a European history major, and I was, you know, wanted to move to India, and there's basically no plausible connection between studying European history and getting a job in India. So I applied for a job at the place that really does not care what you know, and will just send you anywhere, which is McKinsey. So I got this job in the India office of McKinsey. And as soon as I got there, I realized that I was a disaster for it, and it was a disaster for me. But I had managed to kind of get myself to India. I was within weeks advising an Indian pharmaceutical company on its leadership development system, even though I knew nothing about India, pharmaceuticals, or leadership. But there I was, and it just felt very fraudulent to me. And so I immediately started looking for other things as soon as I got there. But I was there, so that was an advantage. And I had applied for all these journalism jobs before I left, and they said, no, we're not sending you to India. But once I was in India, it was a little easier. And I got hired by the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune to become a correspondent there when I was, I guess, 23. And kind of never looked back. Wrote my first book about India. That's the book I came here to talk about 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago, about the transformation of modern India, called India Calling. Then came back to this country in 2009, and John Stewart, actually, on that same book tour that brought me here, John Stewart captured what in many ways has been the story of my life in his brilliant way with a one-liner. He said, you know, your India book basically says the American dream is live and well, but only in India. Hmm. And in some ways, that's been the thesis of my work. I told this extraordinary story of the rise of hope in India, and came back to this country in 2009 and saw that hope was drying up at the source. So I wrote a second book about that, about a hate crime in Texas that kind of brought up those questions of the two Americas. Mm. Around the time of my first book, was invited into this fellowship as kind of one of the weirdos to be kept around. I wasn't really in their world. I didn't really, you know, I didn't have a house in Aspen or a jet or anything like that, but I, you know, was living a modest life in Brooklyn, but at the same time got to be adjacent to a lot of those spaces. And it's common with a lot of writers and journalists. Mm-hmm. And began to feel a lot of misgivings with the world that I was now around.
What sense of responsibility do you feel at this time? Because, you know, again, what you're saying, a number of activists, people who work for groups that are working to make life better for people who can barely make ends meet, people who are unhoused. I mean, there's some people doing really great work, and they don't have the opening that you do. They're not being invited to Google. They're not being invited to the Aspen Institute, right? So what sort of responsibility do you feel at this point, given that you do have all of these open doors and they don't?
A tremendous one. I mean, that's the power of reporting, right? I mean, I interviewed people like that and spent time with them and talked to them all the time in order to be able to, you know, I think as a reporter, you are the intermediary between people's stories and people who might or might not listen to those stories. And often people are kind of unwilling or unable to listen to people directly. That's changing in the Twitter age. I mean, there's a lot more disintermediation. You know, you think about a book like Catherine Boo's extraordinary book on the slums in India, Behind the Beautiful Forevers. I mean, a lot of people read that in India, a lot of people read that outside of India. I mean, it was possible before that book to go meet the slum dwellers yourself or to go get involved in the organizations that we're working with. It was possible. But I think it sometimes takes a writer or an artist's sensibility to distill that in a way that makes it seeable for people, because people are busy and overworked and tired and dealing with issues in their own lives. And it sometimes takes the kind of distillation of what people are saying and are screaming into a text or into an artwork to codify it. So I view my job as being to, you know, open a window to people to see what they should have seen before, but maybe didn't.
And Tony writes in, how do you plan to proceed to get the word out? And I would add to that, when you talk to these very powerful people who won't come on this show, I mean, what are some of the solutions that you're proposing at this time?
I mean, I'm cautious about providing solutions precisely because there are so many people out there, as you indicated, who actually do the work of coming up with, like, what would a fairer tax code be? I am not, like, a tax code expert, so I don't want to tell you, well, the marginal rate should be X percentage. So I, I try to point to some of the areas we should look at. So, you know, just to rattle off some of them, I think we need to have a real conversation about monopoly and concentration of power in this country. Now, monopoly is one of these issues where your listeners may have literally just fallen asleep when I said the word monopoly.
Probably not our listeners.
Right, you're not your... But no. it's one of these boring, wonky issues that feels like, you know, the antitrust department, the Justice Department, you know, the division at the at the Justice Department has it covered. This is one of these issues that's tremendously important and has a lot of power over what kind of society we live in.
Yes.
We're basically trending in a direction, if we're not already there, where there's basically one shopping platform, one search platform, and one social network in American life.
Can I give one example? Because I go to a lot of live concerts, and the fee for the tickets, you don't have a choice anymore. It's Ticketmaster and Live Nation. They've merged, and it was approved under the Obama DOJ. If you're going to a concert for $35, the fee could be $15. And I was curious. I thought, who runs this and how much does he make? I figured it was a man. It is. He makes $70 million a year, right? So this is where we're
at. But that jet fuel is not cheap, Rose.
But this is where we're at right now. I met a woman who works at Ross over the weekend. She's worked there for something like 25 years. She's making $13.50 an hour. She's an immigrant who's been afraid to ask for a raise. She stays because she's over 60 and has really good health care. Ross CEO is a woman making, I think it was, I found online, $23 million a year. So this is where we're at.
Yeah.
$13.50 an hour and the CEO is making $15 million a year.
It's barbarism. It's economic barbarism, and we don't recognize it as such. And, you know, I just think so that's an issue where, you know, I think because people don't fixate on the issue of monopoly as much, it's not as sexy as a bunch of other issues. It doesn't have the emotive power of trade, for example, which is like those foreigners took my job that was right here and now it's not here. Monopoly is very important. And the nice thing about monopoly is it's an issue where there should be some bipartisanship, because actually it's about the principle of competition. And Republicans love capitalism and love competition. And monopoly is anti-capitalist. Monopoly is about removing the oxygen from the rest of the economy so that there can actually be healthy competition. So I think we need to have a real conversation about monopoly and competition in American life. I think there needs to be a real conversation about health, you know. The people running on Medicare for All and others are really raising an important question, which is, it is insanely dumb to require so many million Americans to spend so much time sitting around their kitchen tables looking at medical bills, trying to think about what to do about them, instead of thinking about what company they want to start or what office they want to run for or what skill they want to teach their child. We are the only rich country that chooses to, you know, make people die if they work 29 hours a week at Target instead of 30 and therefore don't have health benefits. It's simply a stupid way to go. We need to have a big conversation about social mobility in this country, and that's a conversation about education, job retraining, other things. But we are entering into the robot age, and frankly, we haven't even yet protected people from globalization and all those job losses. And the fact that the thing that is the essence of the American self-image, social mobility, you work hard and you will rise to the level of your hard work, is less true in America than it is in any country in the rich world.
I was struck on that when you talk about healthcare. When you talk to Bill Clinton, he said that the other thing he does with his riches is he helps family members who have health problems because they can't afford their medical bills.
And friends. And he gave me a helpful tip. He said, if you pay the hospital directly, you don't owe gift tax.
You know, we didn't have time to talk about McKinsey. You mentioned that you worked for them. This is a consulting firm that's getting a lot of attention right now. The New York Times had a lengthy report finding that the consulting firm prepared a report that may have played a role in Saudi Arabia's effort to target its online critics. You also reveal in here that when Obama left and wanted to figure out how he can best engage the citizens, he called up McKinsey. So it's this world that kind of moves around, and it doesn't really matter, you know, what political party you're from. And I think that's what's difficult. Like, how do you unravel that?
Look, let me say this. I think right now we are in the middle of an amazing and important contest in American life about how American life is shaped ruled and changed. And one theory holds that it's fundamentally money and markets that are the driving power in the society, how things should be changed. And that's the McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, Davos view of the world, where rich people getting together in a room, deciding how the world should be, is the engine of human progress. J.P. Morgan Chase helping to cause a financial crisis that beached millions of people and hurt millions of people, and then doing an urban revitalization program with $500 million to help cities. That's the way you make the world better. But there's another theory that I'm here to defend, which is the theory of democracy, that you actually make the world better through democracy, that you actually work together as a public, you build movements, you fight for change, and you make change through the law at the root for everybody.
Anand Giridharadas is a writer and former writer for the New York Times. He's got a very important piece coming out soon in the New Yorker, so check out and look out for that. That'll be out when?
Later this week.
Okay, especially if you're in the Bay Area, you'll really want to read this. He's author of the book Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And if you're in the Bay Area, he's speaking tonight at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco at 6:30, 312 Sutter Street. Tomorrow morning at 8:30 at the SOCAP Conference at Fort Mason Center in San Francisco. And tomorrow night at 5:30 at Code for America at Thumbtack, 1355 Market Street in San Francisco. And you can find all of this information at yourcallradio.org. We also air in other parts of the country. Are you still doing book tours and talks?
I'm going everywhere they'll have me.
It'll be interesting to see who has you and who decides to rescind the invitation in the coming months.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, who's at the board. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.